You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we have Eve Andre Larame. She is an artist who's interested in the ways in which cultures use science and art as devices or maps to construct belief systems. She's had work exhibited all over the world, including the Venice Biennial, Mass MoCA, and numerous museums, and she's also received awards such as the Pollock Krasner, the Guggenheim, and many others. She's also taught in numerous schools about interdisciplinary sculpture and performance art and the intersection between science and art. Eve, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, to begin with, why don't we talk about what you're working on right now? What are you involved in your studio at the moment?
Oh, great. Great question. I have been working on a number of projects that have to do with our atomic legacy, meaning the tracts of land throughout the United States, particularly in the American Southwest, where water and soil has been contaminated from the making of nuclear weapons. And much of these activities have happened on indigenous people's land. So through my work, I figure out ways to bring attention to these issues and propose solutions and make captivating visual environments to draw the audiences in. So a number of projects on that. I'm just starting a new project on the Centralia coal fire in Pennsylvania, which is a fire in a very extensive coal mine underground that has been burning since 1962.
God, that's hard to believe. Since 1962, it's been burning?
It's been burning underground, and the entire town of Centralia is now a ghost town. The government has retracted its zip code, and there is a small population of folks who are holdouts that don't want to leave. And but you know, it's either cracks in the pavement and there's smoke and flames that are, you know, pouring out and contributing to greenhouse gases. It's a very interesting site. Do a Google search. It's well worth it.
Wow, where is that exactly?
It's Centralia, Pennsylvania, so kind of in the middle of Pennsylvania. And I love doing research. That is a key component and strategy of my work and has been over the years. And when I find an event or a phenomenon that I feel an urgency about, I start doing research. And that's how I am able to then envision, you know, how my work manifests itself three-dimensionally and through images and videos and installations. So I'm an omnivorous researcher.
And so at the moment you're researching that, and how will, in that particular case, you have an idea of how that will be visualized?
Well, I have some ideas. It's a new project, and so I, as I said, I'm in the research phase, learning as much as I can about the event and the beginning of the event and how it's played itself out over the decades and about some of the community. My next step will be to go there and then to try to find either some environmental scientists or ecologists to partner with on the project so that I can bring in a science component into the work that's based in fact, not in imagination. So I'm thinking of a darkroom installation that will have video. And although I've never done anything like this before, I've been thinking about, you know, in medicine there are these various scopes that are used to explore the interior of the human body, you know, endoscopes
sure.
and other kinds of scopes. And I am wondering if there may be a way for me to arrange with with an institution where those types of specialized cameras or robotic cameras, whether I can use that to actually visualize part of what's going on underground. And another thing that is inspiring me in this regard, in terms of having a remote way of viewing, is, you know, I'm quite concerned about what's going on in Fukushima with the ongoing triple nuclear reactor meltdowns.
Right.
And, you know, we are seeing images come back from these robots that are being used in conjunction with the laborers there in as they're trying to do their best to contain and resolve the problem there. So I'm thinking about remote sensing and then developing those images and that footage into a dark room installation. And then there may be other, you know, there'll probably be photographic material in the installation. And I definitely want to capture people's stories, because I think that it's so important to hear and share stories with one another. That oral culture, that oral history is a part of what brings us together as human beings.
Well, right now, I think that people that are still remaining there and others that have left, it just seems, you know, one of these stories that's kind of incredulous. It seems hard to believe that even is taking place and exists, but there it is, you know.
Fire and brimstone, central Pennsylvania.
I mean, it's sort of like a vision of hell or something, right? It's just endlessly burning and hot in this one place. Always.
And what's happening, I recently met the chief scientist at a science museum in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and he was telling me how there's such a vast network of tunnels underground in Pennsylvania that once they contain the fire, something else will collapse underground, and that will allow the fire to continue to spread. So it's like a rhizome underground, or like, you know, the mycelium of a mushroom underground.
Right.
So it is a very, very interesting story, and I just feel a sense of necessity and urgency to put it out there and keep these people's story alive. And
it's because of the coal mine. It essentially started in a coal mine.
Started in a coal mine in 1962. Yeah, and it hasn't stopped burning since.
Wow. Okay, so let's move back a little bit. I want to ask you about now you're in a position that's a very really sophisticated position of research and development, collaboration, and weaving social issues with political and aesthetic ones. What was your first experience with art? How did you begin getting interested in art as a child?
Oh, great question. Thank you. You know, I made art since I was a little kid, and so I cannot actually pinpoint when I started making art as a kid, but there were pivotal moments as I grew up that were key. And one of those very fortunate events in my life is that I happened to grow up across the street from a public library. And I was raised in a single parent home. I was raised by my mother. That was in Los Angeles, and literally right across the street from the railroad tracks. And on the other side of the railroad tracks, across a footbridge, was a public library. And my mother worked two jobs, so she had a day job. She'd come home, make my brother and I dinner, and I would go to the library. So the library was my babysitter, to some regard.
For her school, when she was working her night job.
When she was working her night job. And so that's how I became a researcher. The library saved my life, I think. You know, I could very well have ended up being a whatever, a juvenile delinquent, but
right.
I ended up being a bookworm. And I studied everything. I would just go down the aisles and, you know, I'd pull out books on literature or plays, and then I'd go to the science section, and, you know, I'd go to the history section, and it was fabulous. So that was a very important aspect of
and
my
childhood. And your brother was also in a library?
He was into horticulture, so he'd be hanging out with his friends who were into science and into horticulture, and I was a park rat. I'd hang out at the park next to the library, and I'd hang out at the library till 9 o'clock at night, and then my mom would pick me up from you know, she just wouldn't want me to walk across that footbridge at night, so she'd come get me around 9 o'clock at night, and it was an amazing, amazing opportunity, and set me off on a trajectory as an artist researcher.
Wow! Did your brother also go into research?
Well, he is a chemist, so yes, and we both had an aptitude for science. And I remember my mother saying to me, "Oh, Eve, wouldn't it be great for you to become a lady scientist?" Those were her words. And even at, I know, even at that time, I thought that that was such a sort of diminutive term.
Right.
But I sort of followed her, you know, intentions when I entered college. And I entered college as a biology major, and I quickly changed my major to the history of science. But I was still I was making art this whole time.
What kind of art were you making then? Throughout this period, so this is high school and undergraduate school. What kind of art were you making?
In high school, I was doing jewelry making, silver jewelry making. And I was doing ceramics. Bob Bassler, who is a very good ceramicist, taught at my high school in Los Angeles. And then in as an undergrad, I pretty much right away tried to figure out ways to bring art and science together. So I, in my history of science studies, I became captivated with alchemy, because I saw this as a sort of root, a historical root in both the arts and sciences. And then it had its sort of psycho-spiritual strata running through alchemy as well, in that the outer work, the work with materials and plants and minerals that the alchemists involved themselves in, was parallel to the inner work of self-transformation. And so this really captivated me. And so I started making everything from artist books to sculptures to drawings and paintings and whatever. But even from that early time, my work was influenced by the sciences.
But that's in undergraduate school when you weren't taking art. You were making all those kind of things.
I was always taking at least one art class and one dance class every semester. And then I had a teacher. Either it was my last semester as a sophomore or first semester as a junior. And her name is Diana Folsom. We're still great friends. She worked for the L.A. County Museum for years, and now she's at the Gilcrease Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She sat me down at the end of the semester, and she looked at me piercingly in the eyes, and she said, "Eve, you need to really seriously think about being an artist." And, I mean, there was this look in her eyes where it's like, there's no question about this. And I'm going, "Eve, but, I'll never get a job, you know. I don't know how to do that. You know, I like making art, but everyone says I should be a scientist." And she just, you know, again gave me that piercing look. And she said, you really need to seriously think about being an artist. And that was the moment of encouragement. And I mean that in the sense that she gave me the courage to make that leap from what was practical, you know, into something that maybe was a little less practical, but was really where my heart was. You know, the people I like to hang out with when I was in college were the guys pouring molten metals in the middle of the night, you know, rather than in the labs, in the science departments. And so it was Diana Folsom who, she turned me. She opened the door and said, you can do this. At the exact right moment in time. And
it's amazing the power of one person like that in our lives, right? I mean, that's incredible. You weren't majoring in art. You're taking classes. You're a scientist. And this one person essentially had an enormous impact on how you were seeing your future.
Exactly. So she was just phenomenal. And then I had a sculpture professor, John Rogers, who I'm still in touch with both of these folks.
And this is still undergraduate school.
Still undergraduate. Yeah. And, you know, I like hanging out with the sculpture students because, as I said, they were always working at night. And it was exciting. And I was doing these crazy artist books, you know. There was one that was called About 100 Chickens, and it was kind of a riff off of Edward Bruchet. And I remember showing this work in a sculpture class among, you know, steel sculptures and bronze sculptures and plaster and wood. And here I am with my books about chickens. And J.R., John Rogers, he kind of was so subtle and delicate and just nudged the conversation. Hey, you guys, let's look at these books. This can be sculpture, too, and this is time-based sculpture. A book is a time-based sculpture. And so he's another person that I really have to credit in my undergraduate years with sort of setting me on a path.
And then that took you to graduate school.
Exactly. Oh. And I went to the San Francisco Art Institute, and I had some fabulous teachers up there. Among them, Mary Heilman and Chris Burden was one of my teachers. I was doing, I sort of entered with a painting portfolio, interestingly, but I then quickly gravitated again towards sculpture and to performance art because they had a really strong program at that time that grew into their new genres program. And so had some great teachers. Bob Hudson was a teacher of mine, Tom Holland. And Chris was great. You know, there was no BS. It was just he always
Chris
got
Bird.
Straight to the point. Yes. And I had a work-study job picking him up at the airport. And he'd fly up from L.A., and I'd pick him up at the airport and drive him to school so we could, you know, we could chat. And I learned a lot in those informal chats as well as in class. And then after I graduated, I decided I wanted to go somewhere where I didn't know anyone and unlearn school.
Okay, wait, before you tell me what that is, because that sounds great. I'm interested in, I love the idea of, you know, car rides with Chris Burden. I mean, that seems like that must have been, that's also a wonderful little experience that
it really was.
Put you close to someone who's, you know, a seminal figure in his field.
Yeah.
How was that? What was his influence on your work, do you think?
Well, you know, one of the things that I learned, a lot of things I learned from Chris, but one of them is to, you know, live a jargon-free life as an artist. You know, as I said, there was never any BS. It was just, you know, when he would talk to you about your work, if there were aspects that were unresolved, he'd just come right out and say, I don't get that. I don't get it. And tell me about it. And if there was any indication that you were trying to couch your ideas within art speak or mask them with, you know, things you were learning in your philosophy or theory classes, he'd come right back, he'd bring you right back down to earth And I appreciated that. And I also appreciated being able to have a conversation with him about the shoot piece. And because, of course, like every other young artist, I was fascinated with it and also frightened by it.
The piece in which he was shot.
Yes.
With
and
a gun. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I asked him about it directly. I said, you know, why did you do this and what was it about and what did you learn? And he said that, you know, it was done off campus. It was done at the F Space Gallery that a number of these UC Irvine students founded in Irvine in the 70s. And it was during the Vietnam War. And he said that he wanted to feel what it was like to be shot at, not necessarily to be shot. That he wanted to be able to feel the heat of a bullet that came very close to him, maybe even grazed the skin, but not actually penetrated. And that whoever was the person with doing the shooting, I can't remember whether it was Michael Brewster or who it was at this time, too many years, apparently lost aim, got nervous and lost aim. So it was a shock to him. It was a shock to everyone in the room. And when you look at those videos, you know, you can absolutely tell that that's the case. And so what I learned from hearing his story.
Because the bullet went through his arm, right? Is that what
happened? Which wasn't really his intention. What I learned is that sometimes what goes out there in the world as an artist's work isn't always correlated to what, you know, what the artist's intentions were. That there's a certain point where, it sounds cliche, but an artwork has a life of its own. And that piece in particular went off on a whole different trajectory than, you know, what the originating intent was and kind of catapulted him into a realm of being known as an artist that is, you know, sort of pushing these extremes. And,
well,
but it's so interesting. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wasn't his piece where he was crucified on the Volkswagen before that also?
I'm not sure. It may have been, it may have not been. But with the shoot piece, from what he told me, he didn't intend it to pierce through his arm.
Huh.
And so the thing that I learned about vulnerability, you know, and how the experience made him feel very vulnerable, and then how this work then went out into the world framed with the, you know, Chris Burden, the artist that shot himself in the arm, you know?
Right.
And so it's interesting. All artworks, I think, have a factual and a fictional life to them, especially those artworks that are out in the public arena.
Hmm.
And so that's a profound thing that I think I learned when I was in graduate school.
And then you left graduate school before I interrupted you and asked more about Chris Burden. And what was this kind of new world you were entering into?
Oh, the years of unlearning school. Within, you know, weeks of graduating with my MFA, I decided that I wanted to live somewhere where I didn't know anyone, where there wouldn't be any outside influences for my work. And I wanted to really unlearn what I learned through my teachers and what I learned through school and really get to the core of what it was that was driving me as an artist in my own work and research, you know, kind of get back to that core, which in a way is getting back to the thing that drives you when you're a little kid, you know. And for me, it was this infinite curiosity about the world and how we formulate knowledge, how do we build knowledge as a human being through the arts and sciences. So I packed up my American Motors red Javelin with a white vinyl top. And I drove out to New Mexico, and I was headed for Santa Fe. My car broke down first in Barstow, California. Radiator went out there, and I was waited a few days in the middle of the Mojave Desert waiting for a radiator to come in on a Greyhound bus. And
Oh my God,
it was a real adventure. And then onward toward Albuquerque, and the intention was to continue on to Santa Fe. Well, my timing gear went out in Albuquerque. And so that was a big job that needed to be done, and all the money that I had went into rebuilding my engine. So I ended up in Albuquerque, and which was great. I didn't know anyone there. I ended up, renting a place very cheap. It was very, very cheap out there at that time. You know, like 3,500 square feet for $135 a month. Two interesting things happened fairly soon, one having to do with my work and another having to do with my livelihood. As far as my livelihood goes, myself and after I had met some other young artists formed an arts organization called Art Media, and we wrote a bunch of grants and invited a bunch of wonderful artists to come out to New Mexico, people like Hans Hacke and Jenny Holzer and Terry Allen, and so I invented a job for myself in New Mexico,
before you go on, this job you invented for yourself, so as you said, you're trying to unlearn everything in the art world, you're in Albuquerque, and the job you invented for yourself was founder of this
artist-run
organization.
Exactly. It's like, how can I make this work? You know, I'm right out of school. I have an MFA. I can't go directly into teaching. You know, I knew that I needed to somehow accumulate enough experience. I wanted my work to mature to the point where, you know, I had developed the work so that it was truly my own, you know, truly my own voice and truly my own way of manifesting the work in its physical and formal embodiment. And so I knew I had to make a living, you know. As I said, I came from very modest family background. So it's like, what am I going to do for a job here? And so I had met some interesting young artists at the time, Dwayne Griffin and Ann Zimmerman, and we started brainstorming about how great it would be to do a billboard project. And then an older artist in the community, Patrick Clancy, encouraged us to open that up and invite other artists into the project and maybe write some grants to get some funding to do it on a larger scale. And so the first thing we did was make ourselves letterhead, right? And then we went to the city of Albuquerque, talked to them about our project, and said, will you donate us office space and a desk and a phone and a photocopier? And they did. They gave us an office for free and a lot of advice. And then we went up to the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe and said, will you be our fiscal sponsor? We want to write some grants, and we want to invite our favorite artists. And they were so generous, and they said yes. But, you know, you really should not just apply for local grants. You should apply for some national grants, like from the National Endowment for the Arts. And so I said, well, how do I do that? And they said, well, call them up or write to them. I called up the NEA out of the blue. You know, I'm like 24 years old, you know, young punk rock, you know, young artist making their stuff in the middle of the desert. And they encouraged me to fly out to Washington, D.C. and meet with them. And so I did, and that's
amazing. It's hard to enjoy, but that wouldn't happen now. Why did they encourage you to come out and meet with them?
They were wonderful. They, you know, at that time in the NEA, they had what was called Artist Forum grants, and they had InterArts grants for just the kind of project that we wanted to do, and they were trying to reach out to underserved communities. And so when I told them about what we wanted to do, which was to use mass media, billboards and newspaper, radio, TV, as a vehicle for art rather than art museums and art galleries, they said, this is fantastic. We want to help you get these grants. If you can get yourself out here, we'll spend some time with you and teach you how to write an institutional grant. So I went out to D.C., and I met with them for a couple days, and they were fantastic. And I remember them telling me that I should meet Jock Reynolds, who at that time was working for the WPA, the Washington Projects for the Arts. And they said, go meet Jock Reynolds. He'll help you. So I went and I met Jock Reynolds. It's like, hi, I'm Eve Lerme, and I want to do this thing in New Mexico. And he was great. And he said, Eve, there's two kinds of stress in life. There's good stress and there's bad stress. You want to structure your life and this organization that you want to start so that you have good stress and not the bad kind. And he says, I'm going to Xerox some of my successful grant applications for you so you can see how we do this at the WPA. And I asked him about how do I raise funds from private people, or if I want to go to businesses in Albuquerque to try to raise funds. And he said, well, you know, you basically got to get a suit and, you know, and present yourself professionally. And so armed with all of this information and paperwork, I headed back to New Mexico. And I went to the thrift store and I bought a cream-colored silk blouse and some fake pearls. And that was my uniform for fundraising.
And that and came through. So you asked private individuals for funding as well.
Yes. Yeah, private individuals, and then went to the various media companies to ask for billboard space to be donated, airtime on TV and on the radio, and print space in the newspapers and local magazines. To donate space for art. And then we, you know, commissioned various artists to do these projects, including Jenny Holzer did her first billboard project with us, printed billboard project, which was about Reagan's Star Wars. Maybe you remember that, the anti-ballistic missile campaign. And so I wrote some grants, and then I, you know, would go to these various companies to ask for either cash or in-kind donations. And within a year and a half, myself and my two partners, we had raised over $100,000 in in-kind and cash donations. Just being young art kids, you know, making it up as we go.
Putting on nice clothes and being professional and
asking. Yeah, asking with a non-selfish tone of voice. And just like, this would be great for New Mexico, and these artists would love to come to New Mexico, and we've got to treat them really nice and put them up in the fancy hotels and pay them a stipend, and, you know, and we're going to do this great public art thing, temporary public art, for New Mexico. So we ended up doing 40. Jenny's billboard run, I think, was 40 billboards on highway, interstate 25 and 40. Paul Bob from the team Bob and Bob, the performance team, did another series of billboards. And Rachel Rosenthal did one big hand-painted billboard. Or the billboard company fabricated it, hand-painted it, on animal rights. So it was all political art that we were showing in the public arena. And so I learned a lot from that experience. And I think that, again, going back to what I learned in grad school, I think one of the things I learned from Chris Burden was, you know, those pieces that he did that were those 30-second TV spots, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I think that that's who I learned from, that you can, that artists can use the mass media as a vehicle, you know, as a tool or as a venue. And so that was a moment of empowerment for me when I realized that, oh, you don't have to operate in the gallery and museum world all the time. You know, again, you can sort of make things up as you go.
Well, and work directly with media. I mean, that's what you're saying was partly influencing your success and drive to reach out to media and papers and ask them. Is that correct?
Yes, it was great. And, you know, and there was also moments where we had to negotiate a little bit of censorship, where there were some things. Jenny Holder did an insert in the newspaper, and there are a couple of things on one of her, pieces that are her definitive sentences, you know.
Right.
A couple of things that the newspaper didn't want to publish. And so we had to go back to Jenny and say, you know, they're saying that this is, you know, it's going to upset their readership, blah, blah, blah. How do we deal with this? And it was a back and forth negotiation. And we held our ground that this was art and that our intentions were good, that they weren't to harm anyone. The same thing with Rachel Rosenthal's animal rights billboard. It was about the rights of rodents, lab rodents, and how rats are our ancestors. And there was a community, part of the community that was very religious, that said that this was, you know, pro-evolution, anti-creationism, and
right.
that how dare you compare human beings to rats. And so
right.
we, you know, had to get out there and in, you know, calm tone of voice, talk to the public and say, you know, this is what the artist is concerned with. And the intention here is not to outrage people, but the intention here is to initiate discussions and conversations about subjects that may be a little bit difficult to wrap your head around. So it was a real education. It was a real extension of my education to run that organization. Art
and it
media.
Doesn't actually sound like an unlearning of everything that you did in college. So, I mean, you were in a new environment, but you were learning all about arts administration and
it's interesting.
And collaborating, really, right?
Yeah, I was. I was also learning about building community and the importance of that after you get out of school, you know.
I
was just going to say, by going to a place where I deliberately going somewhere where I didn't know anyone and starting to build community from, you know, point zero was important, was an important formative thing to do.
And what was the next step that brought you to your first show or a show that was important for you in terms of your own artwork and moving towards this where you are now, which is work that's so research-based and seemingly socially engaged as well?
Right. Well, there are two events. The one that got me my first museum show happened when I was in Albuquerque. I had read a review of Bruce Nauman's work in the Albuquerque Journal, which is the local newspaper. And it was his, you know, those like smoke rings. They were underground. There were models for huge underground excavated tunnels. And the actual works were never built, but he showed these quite large plaster models of them. They were like 8-10 feet across. And the review in the Albuquerque Journal was, to my thinking, not particularly insightful. And it was, to my mind, a misunderstanding of Nauman's work. And I was then, and I still am, a huge fan of Bruce Nauman. So I crafted a rebuttal to this review as though I was crafting a work of art. And I sent it into the newspaper, and they published it. And I get a phone call the next day from the director of the Albuquerque Museum. And he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm a new artist in town. My name is Eve, and, you know, I really loved the Bruce Nauman show, and I thought that the review was inaccurate, and I just had to say something about it." And he said, "Well, that's just great. Myself and Alan Landis," his name was Jim Moore, and the curator at the time was Alan Landis, and he said, "Well, Ellen and I would really love to meet you. Why don't you come into the museum and, you know, sit down with us?" And it's like, okay, sure. So I made an appointment with them, sat down, and brought my slides in. And, you know, we talked for about an hour, and then I said, do you mind if I familiarize you with my work? I'd love to do that. And they said, fine. And they gave me a show on the spot. They gave me my very first one-person museum show. And it was because, again, I, you know, used my voice to reach out to the community about something that I cared about. And it happened to be Bruce Nauman's work. But that's how I got my first museum show. So it's interesting. And then in terms of the content of my work, which also originated, you know, around these same years, the content of my work, you know, in that I'm interested in these environmental issues. I was reading the newspaper, Albuquerque Journal, one morning, and there was an expose. This was in 1980. There was an expose about the Church Rock uranium mill tailings pond spill, which is something that very few people have heard about. And this was a spill of uranium mining sludge that had contaminated the Rio Puerco River on the Navajo Reservation. And it happened 3 months after Three Mile Island. So everyone was focusing on Three Mile Island. And it happened on the Navajo Res. And it never really made it into the mainstream media. And I'm reading this article about these women who were herding their sheep across the Rio Puerco River, and they'd get sores on their legs that wouldn't heal, and they didn't know what they were. And then you saw, you know, a generation of these babies being born with birth defects. And then you started seeing cancer clusters, you know, all within, you know, a year and a half after this spill happened. And so there was this big expose. And I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, I can't tolerate this. I grew up as one of those duck and cover generation kids of the Cold War, you know, where in elementary school we'd duck under our desks and the air raid sirens, civil defense sirens would go off. So I was already sensitized to things like nuclear war, but I didn't know anything about where those materials came from, you know, where they were mined, how bombs were made and where they were made and, you know, all of that. And so reading this article, it politicized me in that, you know, it spoke to me, and it said that this is an important thing and you need to let people know about this, and you can do it visually because, you know, you have this ability to make things visual, to tell visual stories through sculptures and photographs and videos and, you know, just start getting this word out there. So that was how the content part of my work developed. So it all kind of came together for me at those, you know, those early years of the 1980s when I was out in New Mexico.
And that's fascinating. So that's clear. And that, and how did that bring you to New York? What was the step to get to New York? You still were not teaching at this point.
No, I wasn't.
Your income is coming still from the organization that you continue to run.
Yeah, the job that I created, and then also I was doing some residencies through the New Mexico Art Council. I was doing some short residencies in very interesting communities. And then, you know, around 86, so 80 to 86 is when I was living in Albuquerque, and in 86 I thought, you know, it's been wonderful. I love New Mexico. I love California. I've never been to New York. And I feel like I could have a dialogue with an international community if I was based in New York for a while. And I thought to myself, well, give it 5 years. See if you like it. And so I packed up my car. Now I had an old Volvo Junker. I had gotten rid of the American Motors Javelin and now had this other old car and drove across, took out the back seat, basically sort of turned it into a pickup truck, and drove across the country and ended up in Dumbo back in the early days of Dumbo when there were still feral dogs on the waterfront.
That was the 80s.
86, yeah, and lived in my studio down in Dumbo illegally for a while, and then found out about Greenpoint, Brooklyn, that it was cheap. It was dirty and cheap, you know, and we had all the, we had an incinerator that was running out of compliance with EPA standards, the old sewage treatment plant, but it was cheap. So I moved from Dumbo to Greenpoint sometime within that first year of being in New York City. And then the next year I got a studio at the Clock Tower through the PS1 program. And that was how I pretty much met everybody that, you know, at that time that I knew in the art world, was through the program at the Clock Tower, and Tom Finkelpearl was the director of the Clock Tower at that time.
That was a residency program, right?
Yes, it was PS1 satellite program. The Clock Tower was overseen. It was the umbrella was PS1, but
right.
In Tribeca they had this satellite studio program, and so I had a studio there for a year and. Got to know a lot of people through that.
Oh, that's fascinating. And then when was it that you began? So you're still making your living as an artist. Are you going between Santa Fe and still running that organization? Or
no, I was just finishing up the final reports on the grants and getting together the documentation and, you know, organizing it. And you know, decided to sort of close that chapter and see what I could do in New York. And so the way that I got my, I showed with a few other commercial galleries before, but I was in a show at PS1. It was kind of one of these big New York young artist shows. And John Gibson came by and saw my installation there. And he said, I want to have lunch with you. So he took me out to lunch and he said, you know, kind of right on the spot, he just said, you know, I want to snatch you up before anyone else does. And I said, well, you know, I don't know if my work is saleable and, you know, I'm doing these, you know, these installations. And he said, no, I want to work with you. And so I worked with John for, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 years, something like that. And
he had a gallery. That was when you were showing in his gallery?
Yeah, on his Prince Street gallery, Prince and Broadway. And so I was showing with John and then doing various museum shows of installations at different places and having opportunities to show in Europe. And that was an exciting time in the 90s now. And in the mid-90s, I think, is when I started teaching as an adjunct at NYU. And Gerald Pryor reached out to me at NYU, and he had seen my work at a show, I think, at the New Museum, and said, "Give me a proposal for your dream class." And I said, "Sure." So I wrote it up, and he says, "Well, now come be a visiting artist, and let's see how you interact with our students." And students liked me, I liked them, and he said, "Come back next week, you know, let's continue these crits." And I did, and then either the following semester or the next year, I had my first adjunct class, and then just, you know, continued to teach part-time. Then in the late 90s, had my first half-time job at Sarah Lawrence College, which was a great gig. And continued to make my work, and then I started teaching full time in 2001. And I've just started a new job at Pace University. I'm their new chair of art and art history. And in between there, I was at MICA for a long time, commuting between Brooklyn and Baltimore. And studio in Williamsburg, living in Greenpoint, commuting down to Baltimore. It was kind of a crazy commuting schedule. But now I've consolidated my studio. I own a big house in Greenpoint. I was able to get into Greenpoint when it was still cheap and dirty, you know. And
right.
So now I have a row house in Greenpoint, and my studio is there, and as well as my living, and have a nice backyard, so I can work inside or outside, and
sounds wonderful. That brings us up to the present and what you're working on, and I think, yeah, it's kind of wonderful hearing your path in many respects for artists, but especially with fundraising and community building and social engagement. If, you know, you've gone through all that, and the world is different now for artists, and it's not different for artists in many ways. In closing, is there anything you'd like to say to artists out there who are listening and trying to extract parts of this for what fits them and doesn't, and apply it to how they're moving through the world?
Sure. And because you're, you know, Yale Radio, I also want to reach out to the students there. And, you know, first and foremost, you get to make it up. You know, you get to make up the life that you want to have as an artist, which is a responsibility as much as it is a gift, you know, that you have this gift, and that you can make a life for yourself where you are an inventor of the future that you want to live in. And so, you know, you can think big, and you can always edit down from that. But, you know, do set your sights on the best-case scenario. You know, make good friends and be loyal to your friends. And don't feel like you've got to be in the center all the time. You know, one of the most important things in my own life as an artist is, rather than staying in San Francisco or moving back to LA or moving to New York right away, I went and lived out in the middle of nowhere. And that was how I was able to design the life that I wanted to have as an artist, you know. And it's not a race. Your life as an artist is not a race. It is something to be shaped and molded and crafted just like anything else.
Thank you so much for being with us today. I think it's wonderful to hear your process, and that last thought was, I think, very important and helpful.
Well, great. It's been really a pleasure, and I want to thank you again for inviting me to be part of this. It's a wonderful series, and I wish you all the very best.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.